Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 171, the story of Zwangindaba's exodus from Pongola to Lake Tanganyika, a remarkable story of the Ngoni. Just a refresher, last episode, we heard how the British had decided to include the ceded territories into their sphere of direct control after the Seventh Frontier War. Now it's time to swing around Southern Africa again, because as Geoffrey Chaucer wrote in Canterbury Tales in 1395, time and tide wait for no man. It's from the prologue to the first story called The Clerk's Tale, and the story is imbued with what modern academics call masculine authoritarianism. It's about women's power, actually, and insubordination. The plot dealing with a woman called Griselda, who rises to the highest position of hegemonic power. She becomes the honored wife of a wealthy lord through utter submissiveness and essential silence. To many modern folks, she represents a kind of prescriptive anti-feminist propaganda. In other words, a very accurate description of the medieval period. Others say the strong and silent type is fundamentally insubordinate and deeply threatening to men and the concepts of power and male identity. Griselda was apparently a good peasant girl transformed into the perfect noblewoman. She also happened to rule the territory when her lord was away and was acclaimed by all. She garnered respect by ruling wisely, whereas her husband was regarded as a brute, sadistic, a tyrant. By being the strong, silent type, a kind of Clint Eastwoodian woman, she flipped the concept of what power is. This story is fiction, but based on the mores and values of the time. Chaucer's tales have an oral history ring to them. The narratives are all believable. So it is with some caution that we tread backwards in time, for one person's feminist is another person's pronoun. By 1847, the Matabele, had they become known, had settled beyond the Mutopas Mountains in western Zimbabwe. The Amandebele, who you know by now, have played such a predominant part in our story. They may be north of the mountains, but Mzilikazi's influence extended as far south as the Mutlutsi River. The original Kalanga inhabitants of this region, for example, were forced to retreat or become vassals of the Amandebele. But Mzilikazi was not the only ruler who fled from Zululand, from Shaka, to the north. It's time to consider the peculiar tale of Zwangindaba Gwaza Kaziguda Jeli Gumbi, otherwise known as Zwangindaba. He was the first king of the Ngoni and Tumbuka people of Malawi, Zambia and Tanzania, of the Jere Ngoni clan. And this is a very important part of our tale. What is this, I hear you ask? Why is Zwangindaba part of the history of South Africa? Well, as we all know, lines drawn on maps are cartographical magic codes. The real world has no place for these smoke and mirrors. Zwangindaba was a king of a clan of the Ngoni or Mongoni people, who broke away from the Ndwandwe Kingdom alliance under King Zwide. After the defeat of the Amandwandwe forces under Zwide's command by Shaka, Zwangindaba gathered his clan and fled their home near the modern town of Pongola. This dispersal was part of the movement of the people we call the Mbatlani. Remarkably, Zwangindaba led his people, who took on the name Jele and Ngoni, on a wandering migration of thousands of kilometers, lasting more than 30 years. Their journey took them through the areas of what is now northern South Africa, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Zambia and Malawi to Tanzania. The Ngoni, originally a small royal clan that had left KwaZulu-Natal, part of the Amandwandwe, fragmented eventually into separate groups following Zwangindaba's death. He passed away in July 1848 and his son Gwaza Jele inherited his position. He was the older brother of Somkanda Kaziguda Jele, who was also known as Gumbi, who had founded the Gumbi clan in KwaZulu-Natal. Using many of Shaka's warfare methods of rule, such as rigid discipline and military and social organization, Zwangindaba knitted his nation together and then began to conquer people as they migrated into Central Africa. This is a remarkable reversal of the usual storyline that the Nguni people only migrated south from their original home in Central West Africa. The story is also significant, all the more so because the migration proceeded across the Zambezi River in 1835, on a day when oral history reports there was a total eclipse of the sun. The heavens took notice, in other words. King Zwangindaba was alleged to have used some mythical Nguni esoteric knowledge and occult science, and thus on reaching the Zambezi, the waters of the river were reputed to have parted and opened to make way for him and his people, although obviously historians tend to think that this was a compression tale mixing Christian storytelling and original African storytelling, Moses and the wandering Israelites, and so on. What we do know is that the Jeli people of Zwangindaba were feared and loathed because as this group advanced north, they ravaged the countryside. The reason to include this part of our story now is that they had been on the move since the days of Shaka and only arrived in Tanzania around 1848. Then, on the death of Zwangindaba, the Nguni split into at least three main groups. One settled in Malawi, one in Songea in Tanzania, and the third migrated north to Mbogwe near Lake Victoria, where they fought with the famous Marambo. Gee whiz, who knew? Here was another stunning migration of people from the far south to the tropics, all happening in reverse of what is the common perception of the migrations of people in Africa. As I pointed out through the series, the flow of people was like the tide back and forth, and this has been going on for perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, as long as Homo sapiens has emerged from Africa. Zwangindaba was a legendary leader, the son of Tlachuao, an Induna of the powerful Ndwandwe chief in Zwide, who occupied the country to the north of the Black Umfolozi River in northern Zululand. As you know, their southern neighbors were the Amamtetwa and a host of other people who spoke the same language, including the Kwabe, the Tsele, and of course the AmaZulu. It was pretty early in Shaka's empire building that he turned his attention to Zwide and the Amandwandwe, and a protracted struggle followed. Zwangindaba, like his father, was one of Zwide's Ndunas and was reckoned to be one of his most successful generals in the fights against Shaka. In 1819, however, Zwide's armies were finally defeated at the Battle of the Mhlatuzi River, close to where I grew up, and the broken remnants took their women and children and fled north and eventually collected, together with many other refugees from Shaka's reign of terror, in the country to the south of Delagoa Bay. This is where we need to incorporate Soshangana into the story, along with his four brothers, Majole, Nginea, Mpisi, and Zikata. All of these leaders took the Amandwandwe parties, leaving their ancestral land at Chaneni, fleeing before Shaka, taking a route along the eastern foothills of the Lubombo Mountains through Ngomozulu country to the Up Ntembe River vicinity in the first quarter of the 1820s. Yeah, Soshangana was temporarily beyond the reach of Shaka and lived in the Tembe area for about 5 years, enriching and strengthening himself by constant raiding. Just after 1825, he crossed the Tembe River and marched in a northwesterly direction. Between 1825 and 1827, Soshangana lived on a tributary of the Nkomati River north of Delagoa Bay. During his sojourn in the territory of the Tembe, Soshangana defeated almost all the clans in the vicinity of the bay without encountering any resistance, raiding their cattle in the main. The Tembe's young women were taken captive, and the defeated young men were incorporated into his army. The older men were killed. Soshangana was reinforced by many Amandwandwe refugees after their defeat by Shaka. Soshangana and his people stayed in the region of Delagoa Bay until around 1828. It's about this point that the main character in this episode's story, Zwangindaba, emerges. His kraal was called Ekwendeni, and the kraal in which he placed his second and most important wife, Lompetu, was called Mbeyeyeni. Lompetu was an Nkumayo clanswoman and kin of Zwide, the leader of the Mkumalo clan of the Amandwandwe. After some time, Zwangindaba approached Soshangani for permission to journey onwards to the north, although it's not entirely clear why. The story goes that Zwangindaba was given permission only for Soshangani to go back on his word, and then he attacked the advance party and killed or captured most. Zwangindaba then counterattacked and recovered many of the captives and his cattle, but he lost his first wife and his little son, Indindani, although Lompetu and one or two other wives survived, so the succession was not unduly affected. After this setback, he moved on to the country of the Tonga, the lower Limpopo, before continuing north into the Midlands of Zimbabwe. During his people's stay in Zimbabwe, there were two events that had a profound effect on the disputes. The story goes that Zwangindaba wanted to marry a Swazi girl in his following, whose name was Muneni. She is very important in our tale. As with all stories, a lot of drama followed. Apparently, Zwangindaba mistakenly married her younger sister Kutu, who looked similar, but later on discovered his mistake and then married Muneni as well. Two sisters now married to this influential chief. I mean, what could go wrong? Both bore him sons, and you can guess where this is going. Which was the senior son? Which was the junior? Zwangindaba had further muddied the anthropological waters by providing houses to both wives. Usually, only the most senior and great wife was gifted her own house. However, most of Zwangindaba's people apparently believed Kutu's house was actually the senior. This legal point was going to create disputes that caused the Ngoni to break up. Because the two women were Swazis, meant that some have concluded they were actually slave girls captured in a raid as Zwangindaba made his way north. But that's unlikely. Oral historians say that belief is mischief-making. The two were free royal women and thus empowered. While all of these murmurings were going on, another event in the Midlands of Zimbabwe took place which shook the people who hailed originally from northern Zululand. Lompetu, the great wife, was childless. There was and remains a tradition amongst these people who now live in Tanzania and across southern Africa of the ancillary wife, or Tlazi, of the first. The family system is complicated by the existence of houses, the institution springing from the polygamous nature of these marriages. In the case of a royal family, or the family of a notable, these Tlazi houses often form kraals on their own. They are given names, court officials are assigned to them, and they may continue in their existence for many generations, not only locally, but when the clan moves. The notable first marriage means that the first wife remains as the mistress of her husband's kraal itself, while the main wife can actually head off and build her own. Herein lies the Xhosa quote. The most important woman, therefore, is able to build her own residence, her own life, away from the chief, while the first wife remains bound by tradition directly to the home of the chief. I hope this makes sense, because understanding this matrix of social interaction is very important to the depth of social mores and how this upends those who fiddle politically with succession. Griselda the Quiet comes to mind, perhaps a figment of Chaucer's imagination, perhaps someone he met. She's not Lompetu, and yet. Anyway, as the story goes, Zwangindaba was having a few pints of beer at a carousal in an outlying village when pots of beer were sent to the masses from Mveyeyeni, Lompetu's home. Oral historians tell us that upon careful observation, a single human hair was seen floating on the surface of the froth. And then a great cry went up. Someone was trying to orchestrate the great chief Zwangindaba's demise, they said. A posse of warriors were duly dispatched, led by Gwaza Jerry, to kill everyone at Lompetu's home, including Lompetu and the Tlazi of the secondary wife, Soseya. Just as an aside, Gwaza originates from the isiZulu word ukugwaza, which means to stab. The aptly named commander and his men arrived at Mveyeyeni ready to murder all within. However, Gwaza discovered that Soseya was in the throes of giving birth. So Gwaza and his warriors went on to do away with almost all of the people in the royal queen's home, but actually saved Lompetu herself and Soseya's lives, as well as the life of the newly born boy. Then he hid the two queens and the infant at his home called Ilangeni. Months later, when the hubbub had died down, Gwaza confessed to Zwangindaba that he had not killed the two queens nor the son, and the chief accepted the newly born child as his own. The big question in these comings and goings was, could this boy, who'd been named Mpenzeni, be one of the heir apparents? What a conundrum. Then, in November 1835, Zwangindaba and his adherents crossed into what is now Zambia, and, after a stay in the present Bitauki district, he moved on again, first to the Mawiri pools in northern Malawi, and finally to the southern end of Lake Tanganyika. There, at a place called Mapupo, he died in about 1848. But let me explain a few things before we get to this ultimate demise. Extraordinary, isn't it, The preconceptions of the period, these mid-19th century movements, is that people stuck to their lanes, to their little lives in their valleys and hills, living there for time immemorial. But no, that is false. People moved. We have moved. We travel. We traverse. The time and the type of machine we use may have changed, but the practice is the same. So back to Zwang and Daba's problems. As has been explained earlier, the seeds of the trouble had been planted long before. Zwang and Daba's people had a new name, the Ngoni, and their law of inheritance was something to behold. Similar to other transhuman communities, the Ngoni had changed some of their rituals and traditions as they'd migrated. They'd shaken off the doctrine of tanistry, where the leadership of the family descends from older brother to younger brother until all the brethren have been exhausted. In fact, Ngoni law had turned into something like Roman law, in that the death of the father precipitated the dissolution of the family, and each son who was of age became the master of his own family, and if there was a title involved, it went to the senior son in the great house, or Nyumba ya la Sungula. Zwang and Daba began to feel the terrible pinch of age. Simultaneously, he was feuding with his powerful wife, Lompetu. Later in 1848, he succumbed to illness and died at Mapupo in Tanzania. The inevitable succession disputes kicked into gear, further complicated by the Ngoni people's funeral rites. These took an entire calendar year to complete before a new heir apparent took power. But in this case, there was a structural problem, because most thought that none of Zwang and Daba's kids were old enough to don the cloak of king. So after Zwang and Daba's death, there was an interregnum, and an interim regent was appointed, Zwang and Daba's younger brother, Intabeni. One of his first acts on assuming the regency was to order senior wife Munene and her son Mbelwa out of the royal kraal, setting them up in a tiny hovel that was dubbed Mchakachakeni, which means ejected. Humiliation! Here, the royal maiden from Swaziland, living now far away in what was to become Tanzania, treated so badly. Munene, the demoted wife, lived without cattle and bereft of all the trappings of royalty to which she had been accustomed. It was well known that there was a violent enmity between the new regent, Intabeni, and his sister-in-law, worsened by the fact that Munene had a reputation of being extremely sharp-tongued. She had a bitter quarrel with Intabeni before Zwang and Daba died, so she probably saw the demotion coming. Munene was always something of an outsider looking in, and she feared her son was going to be disinherited. When the elders gathered to discuss the future of the Ngoni, Intabeni's section put forward the name of Ngudoi as possible future chief. A handsome youngster, Intabeni claimed Zwang and Daba had selected Ngudoi because he was a sage, a smart man, good-looking, a man's man. But others said Zwang and Daba had preferred Mbalwa, who was the brother of one of his younger wives called Loma Gasi. The big problem was it was not the done thing for an Ngoni king to name his heir. And the fact that Mbelwa was the son of a younger wife made this highly unlikely too. Well, it turned out that neither Ngudoi nor Mbelwa cracked the nod, because more respected elders such as Gwaza Jere demurred and chose Mpezeni. So Ntabeni wisely withdrew her son's candidature. So without getting too confused, things then fell apart significantly. All of Zwang and Daba's surviving wives threw a fit and deserted Ntabeni, going off to live with Zwang and Daba's cousin Mgai. Intabeni was also suffering from a long illness, and she died at that point. This led to insurrections within the Ngoni people that lasted another 10 years, with some of the clan hiving off and heading back south, arriving in Malawi by 1858. So, the Ngoni people that Zwang and Daba had led all the way from near Pongola in South Africa were broken into three major sections, widely scattered over Central Africa. Thus ends this week's episode about the Ngoni, a strange and largely unknown tale of the remnants of the Amandwandwe people from Zululand, who left after being defeated by Shaka, spent some time south of Delagoa Bay, then marched all the way into Tanzania. And some then marched all the way back to Malawi and Zimbabwe and Mozambique. How about that? The movement of the people. Through our series, we've heard of so many accounts of how people have washed across southern Africa, north and south, east and west. There's no direct, distinct route chosen. These journeys are complex, with many stops and many starts. This always amazes me, and we haven't even got to the part about how some of the Dutch-speaking voortrekkers were going to end up in Kenya at a place called El Doret, a place I have visited where the descendants of the Trekkers are all black and the churches have paintings of ox wagons on the walls. Strange but true. That is for a future episode. Next, we'll spend time along the Limpopo River and find out more about what was happening in the period between 1848 and 1850. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate the visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about the episode. You can also register for my little newsletter there. Until next, salagatli.